Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, one of your hosts, and we're here today with Dr. Luca Schultz, a lecturer in digital humanities at the University of Manchester. Dr. Schultz has varied interests, wide-ranging data analysis, the collection of that data, broad trends over space and time, all of which intersect in the topic of today's talk, his first monograph, Borders and Freedom of Movement in the Holy Roman Empire, out this year from Oxford University Press. Welcome, Luca.
Hi, Yana. Nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. It's so nice. How are you? How's Manchester today?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's sunny, which is rare. So that's great.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, I hear you. Definitely. As an Amsterdam resident, I'm familiar with those rare moments of sun where you just want to go out and look at it. So I'm happy to talk to you today. So I've been looking at some of your past publications, and in particular, I want to showcase three of your publications from 2018. Right? Deceptive Continuity, The Polygon in Spatial History, which is in Cartographica, the International Journal for Geographical Information and Geovisualization, which is a publication I learned about from this. Then La Strada Proibita, L'uso delle strade nello Sacro Romano Impero in Epoca Moderna, in Quaderni Storici, which is one of my favorite publications of all time. In English, The Prohibited Street, The Use of Streets in the Holy Roman Empire in the Early Modern Era. And then Le Passeport Insulté, Lettre de Passage en Ambiguïté Territoriale dans le Saint-Empire au VIIe siècle. The Insulted Passport, Letters of Passage and Territorial Ambiguity in the Holy Roman Empire of the 17th Century, which was in a collected volume called The Holy Roman Empire, Social History, 16th to 18th Centuries. And so I see here a triangulation around your monograph, Borders and Freedom of Movement. But I wonder if you could connect those dots for our listeners. How did you come to write this book?
Yeah, well, the book is basically my reworked version of my PhD dissertation, and two of the articles that you mentioned, the Italian and the French one, are basically outtakes or things that grew mm-hmm. out of the book project, and the last one, the one about polygons in spatial history, is something that relates to the work that I've begun when I was finishing the monograph or revising it for publication, which is making maps basically as a way of doing historical research. Mm-hmm. I guess that is how those three how those are connected. I think, I mean, if you like, I can say a couple of things about how I came to write about this
Absolutely.
Yeah, about this topic. So. I'm German Italian. I grew up in Germany for the most part. I also lived in Italy as well. And when I started college, I actually didn't study history. I studied economics. And for some reason, for several reasons, I didn't quite like that. It was a very formalized way of engaging with information. And it was just not for me. And then so I decided to do mm-hmm. history. And I did that in France, because in Germany, it's very difficult. If you have a degree in one subject, they don't easily let you switch your subject then for your master's. But in France, that wasn't a problem. So I went there and was there actually that I stumbled on the Holy Roman Empire, which is something that as a German, we never in school, that was not something that really came up. It wasn't something that we treated. And I think that really made me more curious about it.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm so surprised about that.
Yeah, but I think the... Yeah, I think the German the German curriculum is very much if I recall, I mean, you talk a lot about the antiquity, you talk about the Middle Ages, you talk not too much down. Then basically it's the history that I recall from high school started in the 19th century, right? And then you get the history of Germany, of the Zollverein, you get Bismarck and then obviously you get the you get the world wars, you get the Nazis, you get the early Federal Republic. But yeah, this was a chapter of German history that was completely that I had no idea about. And I took this class and I just came out of these seminars in economics that are incredibly, they're very hard, but they're also very boring. And in a way, they're not intellectually very stimulating, because you just sit there doing differential calculus. And suddenly I sat in that class and I had these two great teachers in Paris, one of whom then became, one of whom supervised my MA dissertation, the other one then my PhD dissertation. And they had this amazing class on the Holy Roman Empire. It was weird and funny. And I think that really, that really captured my imagination. And then I went on to do a PhD at the European University Institute in Florence, which is this, it's basically a European Union funded university. And what's nice about it is that people are admitted by quotas by country. So you get, you get like five Germans and you get like four people from Spain and you get two Italians and you get people, from every member state of the European Union. And so that is where I started this project, right? Writing this history of borders and freedom of movement in the Holy Roman Empire. And I guess what was weird in that context is that it was a place where global history was very strong. And basically all my peers, my whole cohort of other PhDs, almost everyone was working on a global history project. And I was one of the very few who worked on something, I wouldn't call it national history, but it was definitely, right, definitely wasn't global. And that in a way that, and I had to, it was an interesting position to be in. I think ultimately it was interesting because I never liked the idea that to do something that is relevant beyond national history, you definitely need to expand your spatial scope. I think you can do the same thing by talking about problems and questions that are relevant, right, to a broader community than just your national audience. Mm-hmm. And that is what I've tried to do. That is very much what I've tried to do with this book. And the dissertation. Yeah. And in a way, and then after that, I moved on to, I was a postdoc at Stanford, and that is where, in a way, I revised this whole thing. And, and what was interesting is, in a way, I had written this whole, I had this whole manuscript, but I didn't have a single map, but it's a book that is very much about, that is very much about space, right? It's a spatial argument. Mm-hmm. And at Stanford, I was part of this. It's called the Spatial History Project, which is a very was started by Richard White, and it's a fairly exciting environment where they're using, basically the idea is to use maps as a tool of research, right? Not just something to convey knowledge that you already have, but actually to find out stuff. And that is, so I started in a way using information that I'd found in my sources to make maps with that. And that made me also realize, and a lot of those maps ended up in the book, and that made me realize in many ways how powerful a visual argument can be. Right, I can talk for hours about something, but when I show people a map, it's much more effective at making them understand and appreciate. what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. And we see this, right? I was going to ask you more to kind of expand on your methodology, but perhaps you've just done it there. There's this wide variety of sources, and you have some, you use kind of the usual suspects, but then also there's this analysis that I get to see through maps. That's very cool in this book. It's very interesting and it feels new.
Yeah, right. So, I guess I'll talk about that in a minute, but one of the key arguments in the book is that borders did not, up until the mid-18th century, did not actually play a very, a hugely important role in channeling movements of goods and people. And the way I made that argument, well, I made it in different ways, but one way of making that argument was to map out the locations of toll stations on a map. So the places where, if you travel through that landscape, where they would stop you, right, and check your passports. And I realized, well, those, if you put those on a map, they don't coincide at all with the territorial boundaries. So I think that's a good example of how we can use maps to make historical arguments, to engage with spatial data and spatial information. And it's new in some ways, in the sense that, well, we have GIS, right? You have geographic information systems that make that process fairly easy and straightforward. And you have our capabilities for visualizing maps are grown a lot, and it's you can really use it as an exploratory tool of research. And at the same time, historians have been making maps for centuries. So it's an interesting mix of continuity and change that you have there.
Wonderful. Yeah. You've kind of started the answer to my next question as well, but let's get down to it. Like, what do you cover and what would you consider to be the main arguments of your book?
I would say I make three key arguments, or they're three key takeaways from the book. So one is what I call the enclosure of movement. And basically what I argue is that attempts to escort travelers, or to issue letters of passage, or to criminalize the use of forbidden roads were all ways of transforming transit rights into excludable and fiscally exploitable goods. So obviously in practice, these efforts to regulate movements of goods and people were very patchy and inadequate. And mobile populations, so from emperors to peasants, defied attempts to govern their mobility with actions ranging from anything from formal protest to bloodshed. But I think this idea that what we are witnessing here, it can be described as an enclosure of movement, is, I think, that's one of the key. That's the first insight, I would say. The second one is that. Is what I just mentioned, is about the spatial distribution of these conflicts, right? So we know that borders fulfilled very important symbolic and legal functions in early modern Europe, and especially in the early modern, in the Holy Roman Empire. But restrictions on moving goods and people were rarely concentrated at borders before the mid-18th century. Before the mid-18th century, but they were unevenly distributed along roads and rivers. So you have them at choke points like toll gates or mountain valleys. And then I think the third contribution is that I show that there are very intense intellectual debates going on at the time around the polities, so the members of the Holy Roman Empire's right to interfere with freedom of movement. So the empire's political order guaranteed fairly extensive transit rights, which were controversial because apologies of freedom of movement and claims of protecting travelers could also mask fairly aggressive attempts of territorial expansion. So I would say these are the three key points. And in a way, what we have there is, so you have on the one hand strong continuities to medieval patterns, but also more distinctly modern developments in this spatially dispersed and very selective and contentious regime of movement that affected the people who moved through that heart of early modern Europe.
Great. So that's an excellent introduction to your work. So let's go through it chapter by chapter, and we can look at the legs of this argument. So please tell me what you do in chapter one, the ordering of movement.
Right. Yes, that's basically an introductory chapter. And on the one hand, I survey different ways in which early modern societies, not just in the Holy Roman Empire, attempted to promote and restrict and profit from flows and goods of goods and people. What I argue is that this ordering of movement was a key element of state building. And I use a concept developed by a scholar in New York, John Torpy, who called that a monopolization of the legitimate means of movement. Now, obviously, this was something, so governing movements of goods and people was something that was a common problem throughout the early modern world. So from the Spanish treasure fleets to the English poor laws. But what I argue is that there were few places where it posed a greater problem than in the Holy Roman Empire, where you had more than 300 would-be sovereign political entities, some of which consisted of nothing but borders, which is actually something that an 18th century lawyer once said about the empire. And you have many rulers there compete with their neighbors in controlling rights of passage on certain roads and rivers, right, and channeling desired flow through their dominions and diverting unwelcome movements. And in a certain way, there is no, you couldn't wish for a better laboratory for exploring this history than the Holy Roman Empire. And I also talk a little bit about the historiography of the Holy Roman Empire, which is a fascinating thing in itself, which for a long time has been dominated, I would say, and it's a simplification, but I think you can put it that way, has been dominated by two questions. And one question was, was the empire something functional, or was it something dysfunctional? Was it a progressive society in a sense, or was it a backward reality? And that has a very old history. It has a lot to do with how with the presentist tendencies of historians, so especially Prussian historians who tended to write the success story of the Prussian state against the negative foil of, right, that was the Holy Roman Empire. And the other question that dominated the historiography of the Holy Roman Empire is, for a long time, was the question of whether the Holy Roman Empire should be seen as a state or not. And you find all kinds of interpretations. So you have some people who basically saw it as some kind of failed nation state. Others saw it more as a confederation. Some historians described it as basically the first German nation state, called it a complementary nation state. And some people saw it as a precursor to the European Union. And there's been a lot of controversy around that. And what I see is that in recent years, historians, some of the very leading historians in Germany, but also outside Germany, are kind of leaving those questions aside and are looking more at how the Holy Roman Empire functioned as something in its own right. And in a sense, I kind of try to avoid these diachronic perspectives as well, because that's what they are, right? All these narratives only function against the foil of modernity, right? Whether it's the modern nation state, whether it's a society perceived as progressive. And instead, what I try to do is, I guess, I try to take a spatial perspective, which is tricky because historians of empires often struggle to describe empires in spatial terms. And I do it in two ways. I think one way is I try to look at the geography of governability, but I also try to situate the empire in a broader perspective than that of German history. And that is because the historiography of the Holy Roman Empire is largely written, and there are notable exceptions of it, especially in recent years, but the large chunk of it is written in German by German historians, and it tended to be, for a long time, it has also been quite self-referential. So the old Reichsgeschichte was a fairly narrow community of scholars. And what I think is that having studied this and having talked about this in different universities in Europe and in the United States, I realized that, well, the Holy Roman Empire should be of interest to a lot more people than just German historians, right? It's this polycentric, fragmented, multi-layered political order. Mm-hmm. is actually there is a lot. If you look at, so it was, for instance, talking to historians, this historian of early modern Japan at Stanford that I talked to about this, and I realized that, well, actually, the things that we study have a lot in common. Same thing with Ottoman historians. So I think there are conversations to be had there that everyone would benefit from. So in a way, this is also an attempt at making people aware that the Holy Roman Empire is actually, it's not just for German historians. It's actually, and it's also interesting because I think it complicates a narrative of European uniformity that both Europeans like to use, in the sense that it's a good excuse for not engaging with the history of other corners of the world. But I've also seen that historians of other world areas often like to, there's often this narrative where you have basically this notion of Europe as a black box, right? Where you have, for instance, when people talk about the Westphalian state and that model, and then you can basically show how the area that you study is very different from that. And I think what the Holy Roman Empire shows is that it tears that idea of European uniformity and simplicity apart. The biggest exception to Westphalian statehood sits at the heart of Europe, right? It's where the Westphalian peace treaties were signed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing that allows me to do that is this institution of safe conduct, which I'm not going to go into details in explaining what it is. It was, in German, it was called Geleit or Geleitrecht. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously something that you have, it's a widespread institution, right? You find that across the pre-modern world. But it took on extraordinary significance in this fragmented landscape that was the Holy Roman Empire. Because it was one of the, it became basically one of the most important frameworks for negotiating movements of goods and people and their and their restriction. And it could take many forms. It could be originally, it meant the physical escorting of certain travelers and vulnerable groups of travelers to protect them. So those could be merchants or messengers or envoys or Jewish travelers. But it could also be to honor persons of rank, like traveling princes. But it also could just mean the levy of tolls and of customs duties. So, and it was a very ambiguous thing because it served to promote and to restrict mobility. And it changed its shape a lot over the course of the medieval and early modern period. But that is pretty much what I discuss in that chapter.
So I see, like, one of the points that makes this very interesting and such a great place to study is that there are so many borders or borderlands or liminal spaces, right? There's just hundreds of national little boundaries and that intersect of, like, what, you know, nation states, city states, what have you. But then there's all of the waterways and ways that one might get around. So there are these other levels of intersection. And by eschewing what you call, you know, this diachronic model, by eschewing, like, changeover, just a progress narrative or a narrative that works on change over time and talking about how it works with space is ambitious. And it's really cool. But I think it shows up. I think chapter two is a place where you can talk about how chapter two, Theaters of Transit, which is a kind of, you take a look at Wertheim, I think I'm pronouncing that okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a place where you can kind of showcase a lot of your arguments about a lot of the arguments that run through the lines that run through the book. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So the second chapter, yeah, it revolves around this very small county, the county of Wertheim, which was was really minuscule. Actually, it was called the county of Löwenstein, Wertheim, and it was surrounded by powerful neighbors. So on the one hand, the Prince Bishopric of Mainz, and on the other hand, the Prince Bishopric of Würzburg. So powerful Catholic neighbors, small Protestant territory for the most part. And I decided to do that because I visited over 20 archives for this research, and I was lucky to find material everywhere, which was great on the one hand because it really allowed me to find good and interesting and telling material, but it was also a challenge because it's very difficult to synthesize all that information. So, and also to contextualize, and that's something you really need to do when you work in the Holy Roman Empire, because It's such a polycentric landscape that you need to understand what goes on locally to make sense of it. So this chapter revolves around this small county. And it's basically about this act of escorting travelers, right? Mm-hmm. Which was important in the Holy Roman Empire because it was basically a way for a prince to express their territorial claims over a road or a river, but also the boundary of that claim. So there was a moment when they had to hand over the escorted person, the traveler, to the neighbors. And it was important for all imperial state, but especially for those at the bottom of the feudal pecking order, whose claims of territorial superiority were particularly precarious. Now, on this county of Wertheim lay on this river Main, which was a fairly important trade route. And the key point of contention there was the safe conduct for the market ships that went to and from the Frankfurt trade fairs. So basically twice a year, what you have, you get these competing safe conduct processions that quarrel over the right to escort the market ships from the riverbanks. So the way this works in practice is that the counts and their neighbors mobilize hundreds, sometimes thousands of subjects. They assemble them in the early hours of the morning at a boundary stone, and then they have to attempt to escort the market ships from the riverbank. And the way this works is that you have to keep the vanguard of the procession. So everyone, so the competing groups of escorts try to walk at the front of the procession, and so you get all these shoving matches, and actually much worse. So, in fact, many subjects, but even officials, were not very happy about taking part in those processions because they often got seriously out of hand, especially in the case of Wertheim. You had threats, you had insults, mockeries were very common. People would drink on those occasions, but sometimes you get warlike scenes. So people died. I think there was a case in 1602 when the count's market ships that should escort the ships on the river falls into an ambush. Right, suddenly there's heavy fire from both sides of the river, and two subjects die, and one person gets a shot through his foot with a poisoned bullet, and then dies days later. And they what they assume is that the bullets were poisoned. So as a consequence, the commoners often refuse to participate in these processions, or they complain about it, or they just hide away. So I start the book with a quote from a guy called Stefan, who was a baker in Wertheim, and who at some point in a procession grumbled about it and said that, according to the reports, and so I'm quoting the report, says he was so tired of beating the drums that he almost could not move his arms anymore, and that he would prefer to say goodbye to my drum, right, and return it to the town hall. Or you had the fishermen in a small village that almost staged a rebellion. And travelers as well were often annoyed at the practice. They refused to be escorted. The emperors themselves repeatedly asked not to be escorted. The way I interpret these quarrels is that these kinds of disputes were ways of expressing, of rejecting, and of negotiating competing claims of sovereignty, which actually sovereignty is not a good word in this context. It's more, in the Holy Roman Empire, was more about territorial superiority, Landeshoheit. But I think, I try to be more precise than that, because in a way, everything in the Holy Roman Empire is about territorial superiority all the time. Safe conduct is about a very specific aspect of sovereignty, and that is the authority to restrict or to promote or channel or fiscally exploit movements of goods and people, something that was hardly attainable in this complex geography of the Holy Roman Empire. So this order, right, that we see in the safe conduct procession was not simply a sign of laxity or of incompetence. It could be, but for the most part, it was a symbolic expression of the deep controversy that was inherent to the old Reich's politics of mobility.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that you really get to in chapter 3, boundaries. Questioning kind of the lived import of boundaries, but how they played out as well, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So I think what's interesting, when you look at a map of early modern Europe, it's fairly easy to recognize the Holy Roman Empire, right? Because it's so fractured, because it has this incredible density of boundaries. And there's a very big historiography on borders, on boundaries in the Holy Roman Empire. But when I started the book, that was what I was looking to. But at some point, I realized that the ways the word border is used here is that it's seen as something it's something that delimits rights over land and its inhabitants. It's not so much treated as an instrument for channeling moving goods and people. So it's a distinction you could call the one thing the property boundary and the other thing the mobility boundary. And I was much more interested in the mobility boundary than in than in what you could call the property boundary. Now, safe conduct processions, in a way, are a good example, right, for how the border could become a tool for channeling movement, how it could become relevant in that context, because obviously the escorts, they had to agree where to hand over the travelers right to the escorts of a neighboring ruler. So you get these very theatricalized crossing of these boundaries. And escorts would, for instance, when it was at a brook or a river, the escorts from both sides would advance with their horses and have the horses' 4 feet stand in the water on each side. You would have notaries that would be paid to observe the whole scene and write it down. You would have sworn witnesses. Obviously, the local population was very important. And I described that in that chapter and also found some sumptuous maps in Munich that are very rare in the sense that they really give us an exact idea of how these border crossings took place. But that was the one thing. And then, in a way, in that context, yeah, borders are hugely important, right, when it comes to movement. But in everyday life, I realized more and more as I went to the archives, well, territorial boundaries only played a fairly limited role for channeling mobility. And I think that has to do partly with also our contemporary discourse, right? The way we use the word border. Basically, when we say border, it's a shorthand for all state interference with interpolity mobility. So, for instance, when you had a couple of years ago the so-called refugee crisis in Europe, that was framed as a question of protecting borders. But, well, this is really a story that unfolds at internal ports of entry, so mostly at train station and the detention camps that are spread across the landscape. So, and historians tend to use the word border in a similar way, right? When we talk about borders, it's easy to assume, well, a lot of people just use it as a shorthand for contacts between authorities and mobile populations. And that's certainly what I did when I started working on this project. And I think part of the problem is the maps that we use, right, which reinforce this emphasis on the border. Mm-hmm. In fact, many of the ideas and maybe also misconceptions that I had about early modern territoriality came from the maps that I was using. So drawing up, and we already talked about the maps, right? But drawing up the maps that I did then made me realize that, well, actually, borders weren't that important. So when you take a conventional map of the Holy Roman Empire, right, where with all these crisscrossed by all these borders, and you assume that someone is moving through that landscape, you assume that they would be controlled at the territorial borders. But what I did is I then mapped the location of the Tollspätians against those boundaries. Mm-hmm. And what I saw is that they very rarely coincide. There's very little spatial correlation between the two. And if you then take into account the terrain, so the elevation and also the road network, basically what you realize is that Tollstations are located along the main corridors of travel with the lowest elevation. And they are also, for the most part, they coincide with cities and settlements. So in a way, maps of state interferences with trade flows look very different than maps of jurisdictional boundaries for the most part of the early modern period. And in the Holy Roman Empire, this situation only changes, begins to change in the second half of the 18th century and undergoes a more profound transformation. So this is a moment when an increasing number of territories begin to basically relocate the levy of duties to to their outer borders, and also the major commercial hubs within their territory. And you also see that in the discourse. So duties are increasingly seen as a tool of protectionist economic policies, in addition to generating fiscal revenue. And a textbook example for that is Bavaria, where in 1764 the electorate reformed its toll system and basically abolished most internal tariffs and drastically cut its 400 toll stations across the territory. And there were still some internal custom stations, but basically you only had to pay duties when your trajectory involved a border crossing.
Sure.
So in a way, I think methodologically, I think what that showed me is that maybe we should try to get better or more nuanced ways of mapping pre-modern societies, and that those can make a big difference in how we perceive them. And I think for me, at least, one of the main challenges is to just find ways of mapping space that overcome conceptions of spatial order that are primarily concerned with spatial differentiation, right? So where space is basically this flat representational plane that you can visibly partition, it's a flat surface on which states project their dominance, which is a vision of space that found a culmination maybe in the thought of someone like Carl Schmitt. And in a way, it doesn't help that the shapes formed by territorial boundaries are, to many of us, the symbols of the nation state par excellence, right? So you recognize Italy on a map by its boot shape, or French students learn about the hexagon in school. And the problem is space is so much less clearly partitioned in early modernity these partitions overlap. They crisscross a lot. It's a very complex landscape. I think there is a lot of work to be done to find alternative ways of mapping that are more representative of pre-modern spatial orders. And maps can be a powerful corrective, right, to challenge those geographic conceptions that we rely on, often implicitly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and I think recalling that border lands are different as well. Like, you can draw these lines on maps, but exactly where, what is changing? And so, you know, you're going to have linguistic overlap and all of these ways that kind of places culturally overlap. But then if we want to talk about actual trade and carrying goods from one territory to another, from city A to city B, and chapter four, channeling movement, you talk about the methods that have to be used when boundaries are so sketchy. You talk about these ways that methods are used to control transit and trade across kind of these borders. And I'm making air quotes.
That chapter was basically, so I asked myself, so what does all this look like in everyday life? Because if you are a commoner, well, you would rarely be escorted, right? Experience of safe conduct would be, you would see that as a levy of tolls and customs duties, or maybe an obligation to carry letters of passage. But still, that was no less controversial than what you had with these processions. But to make sense of it, you really need to look at what happens at ground level. And in this chapter, I did that. I took the example of Thuringia, which was one of the most fragmented regions in the Holy Roman Empire, probably in early modern Europe, and well, probably even the early modern world. So basically, you have more than 30 distinct political entities on an area that roughly corresponds to what is Swaziland today. And at the same time, you have these strategic trade routes that go through it, that meet in Erfurt, and that go from, that connect north and south and east and west. And the whole region is dominated by one noble family, the Ernestine Dukes of Saxony. They claim the right of safe conduct in the territories of their neighbors as well. Which, as you can imagine, was hugely, the neighbors did not particularly like. And basically, if you travel through that landscape and you were susceptible of paying conduct duties, you would either have to carry with you a conduct ticket, which is basically a receipt that you had already paid your duties, or a passport, and the passport certifies your exemption from the duties. And what the Dukes did is they attempted to monopolize the issuance of passports. So they would only recognize their own. So you would necessarily have to go through their bureaucracies, right? You would plead for a passport. And that entailed, in a way, a symbolic subjection, also a bureaucratic burden, because it basically meant you had to go there. There were long delays as well. And I found one report, I think it was from 1689, that I found in Weimar in the state archives, that reveals that kind of that potential for a conflict, right? The situation was you had a ducal conduct official that encountered a wagoner who was carrying wood on account of neighboring count. And he neither had a passport nor a conduct ticket. So what the conduct official did, he unhitched his horse. And sent the guy for whoever paid him, and he waited there for hours. And at some point, after hours, one of the count's valets arrives and has one hand on the holster, and then basically the report in the archive that I found was written down as a. In the form of a dialogue, and if you like, I can read like the first couple of lines from that dialogue.
Okay, that would be great.
Yeah, because yeah. I think it gives you a good sense of how the kind of emotions right that went with it. So basically, we have the valet who's been waiting there for hours, and some point, the conduct official and who's been waiting there on the side of the road for hours, and at some point the valet arrives and he starts talking to him and says, so the valet says, why do you arrest the things of my lord? Lightning should strike you. And the conduct official replies, I do not arrest them. I want to see the passport. And the valet replies, what passport? He had no passport. Why did he need a passport? Was he not enough of a passport? And the conduct official replies, well, although he is enough of a passport, he should have come for a free ticket. And the valet replies, why did he need a free ticket? If I wanted to see the free ticket, he had it in his arse. He would show me ourselves. And he uncovered his behind and said, here it is. And that goes on for four pages. And there's much more name calling, and I will spare you. I will spare you the rest. But I think what's interesting here is that the rage that this valet has, right, illustrates how the obligation to carry passports could be perceived as an exceedingly bothersome and debasing request, and how the right to move through that landscape was fundamentally negotiated, and how the formal structures that were charged with channeling movement were really inhabited by people who tended to operate on a complex basis of webs of personal obligation and strategic self-interest. And I think we should be very wary of adopting overly hierarchical perspectives on the history of freedom of movement in early modernity.
All right. Let's talk about safe conduct, which you cover in chapter 5, protection.
Right. So chapter 5 is basically, it's about a particular form of safe conduct. It's about, it's about the protective dimension of safe conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the examples, right, that I've given so far were suffused with claims and practices of protection. And obviously, in times of insecurity, escorts or letters of safe conduct were what made movement possible. And at the same time, safe conduct could also easily become a vehicle for enforcing wider claims of dominion, right? For acts of symbolic subjection or for self-serving economic policies. And there is a, in a way, the for a long time, lawyers have and historians as well have conceived, so early modern lawyers have conceived of safe conduct as a fundamentally reciprocal arrangement, right? So the duties that you pay are used to fund escorts, to finance policing efforts or road maintenance. But what I found is that the practice was more muddled than that. So in many cases, the revenues were used for unrelated purposes, or merchants that were robbed found it difficult then to claim a compensation from the safe conduct authority or from the lord. And as in other cases, as in many things that I've seen throughout this book, it's a tension between protection. Protection that you can take at face value and protection that is more, well, a form of violence was negotiated between individuals on the ground. And this particular chapter is about, I take the example of a river. The river is called the Lower Weser, which is the river that connects the city of Bremen, so an important merchant city, with the North Sea. It's the economic lifeline of the city, right? So they really need traffic to be able to cross that river, to move on that river. And in the late 16th and early 17th century, the city placed convoy ships on the river to protect it from freebooters, but also to enforce territorial claims vis-a-vis its neighbors, and particularly the counts of Oldenburg, who mostly sat on the left bank of the river and competed with Bremen in control for the river. And I think it's a good example for the ambiguous nature of protection, right? Because protection on the one hand was necessary. There were freebooters, there were pirates, and you needed there was an actual need for protection. But at the same time, Bremen used its ships to impose its claims of dominion over the river and to protect the economic interests of its citizens and of its fishermen and of its trade companies. So I won't go into the details here, but I think what really comes up here is this deeply ambiguous nature of protection and protection talk. Mm. Right, that you also find in political discourse, where protection and security serve as a kind of scaffolding for a selective conception of freedom of movement, where the mobility of some is permitted while that mobility of other people deemed dangerous is restricted, which is a tension that that liberal democracies nowadays deal with in very eerily similar ways.
Yeah, absolutely. These are themes that sit well. I think one of the crucial things here you talk about is the negotiation, right? That there's constantly a conversation that's going on all sides in order to attempt to have a regulated freedom of movement.
Right.
And so let's maybe we head over there, chapter 6, freedom of movement.
Yeah. So this is the last chapter of the book, and it's different in the sense that in what I did here is I surveyed more the academic discourse, mostly in universities, but also lawyers who wrote long texts on all of these issues. And I think what's interesting is that this limited importance, right, of territorial boundaries for policing everyday forms of mobility, that was also something that I found reflected in the political discourse of the time. So it's not that early modern lawyers in the empire did not talk about borders. In fact, boundaries were a hugely popular concept among 17th century legal scholars. It's that boundaries were increasingly understood as delimiting sovereign polities and the bundles of jurisdictional, fiscal, and other rights that they exercised over their territories. But cross-border mobility and rights of passage played almost no role in these debates. So if you want to know how lawyers understood the ordering of movement, we need to look elsewhere. And I found discussions of around freedom of movement, around transit rights, around mobility, in not in the literature on borders, but in the literature on safe conduct, on customs, on rights over roads and rivers, as well as a scholarship on the problem of transit. And that was interesting to me because the historiography of freedom of movement, which is not huge, but there's a substantial number of publications, is often closely or exclusively linked with questions of emigration or immigration. So long-term forms of right of movement that end with settlement. And these are obviously a very important part of the story, but I think that they somewhat obstruct the view on other historical lineages of free movement, and namely travel and trade. And I think so what the sources that I found do is they show that early modern observers often understood the spatial order of the state and its grasp on human mobility in different terms than the historians. So in the Holy Roman Empire, assumptions about the nature of roads and rivers were among the most important of places where these kinds of discussions took place. So, for instance, some lawyers based their theories of free movement on the assumption that public roads were incapable of possession. So you couldn't own them, right? You couldn't take them into your possession. So, for instance, we had this one guy, Adrian Bayer, who was a barrister in Thuringia, and he compared public roads to the veins and arteries, right, that creep through all the limbs of the human and animal body and divide and link them in turn, so that none of those limbs can regard them as belonging completely to itself. And basically, there's other quotes, but basically I think what you find here is that what these people are trying to do is that they're trying to construct arguments that are constructed somewhat crudely, an analogy to Hugo Grotius's vindication of the freedom of the sea. And these kinds of arguments were hugely controversial in the Holy Roman Empire, where the majority view was that public roads could well be subject to ownership and dominion. So one of the Holy Roman Empire's most eminent lawyers or legal philosophers, or whatever you want to call him, Samuel Pufendorf, expressed, so he took issue with their theories, and he expressed nothing but contempt for the half-baked analogies of his contemporaries, calling these arguments, and I quote him here, so stupid an invention that it needs no refutation. he was not happy. I won't go into details. I think what's important to for this last chapter is that arguments for and against the restriction of passage rights in the Holy Roman Empire, for the most part, rested on opposing conceptions of spatial order. So there were questions of framing, right? Whether you posited extraterritorial thoroughfares or territorial states or humankind as a frame of reference had consequences for whether the movements of goods and people was seen as something natural, right, as a long-established thing of affairs, or as an undesirable exception. I think the other thing that's interesting is that for a liberal academic in the 21st century, it's easy to sympathize with the history, with the intellectual history of free movement, right, and see it as something that aligns well with progressive or liberal agendas. And what I found is that, well, it's more the history of free movement actually has some dark sides in many sense, right? So the most outspoken advocates of free movement, among those, you find lawyers who cater to fairly specific political interests, like those of Sweden, which use its German outpost as a reservoir for troops and provisions and as a basis for participating in the wars on the continent. So we tend to associate bounded territory with that's something that Charles Meyer said in a book that he published a couple of years ago. We tend to associate bounded territory with the capacity to create inequality and unbounded spaces with all kinds of utopian visions of common ownership, right? But I think the early modern history of freedom of movement paints a much more complicated picture. In fact, endorsing freedom of movement, in a way, has always been a privilege of those immune to its dangers. And that is something that I found in these early modern debates.
All right. And there's something beautiful there. There's something really interesting to think about, like whether that again, the negotiation, the constant dialectic between the desire to move freely and the desire to be safe, right? This that really relates still, kind of protecting individual interests or state interests or having open borders, kind of a question. I'm not stating this well, but do you know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah.
This is such an ongoing debate that it really rings. And the idea that we've been talking about it for 500 years is.
Right. Yeah. And it's not a story that we usually project back into that past. It's something that we start talking. Yeah. It's something that usually these stories start in the 19th century, right? When historians write about it.
Yeah. Well, that's when historians start writing about everything too. they were writers. All right, so let's wrap up. I've taken a bunch of your time already. And your conclusion pulls much of this together, and this is a place I'd like you to, you know, make any final points and tell me if there's something else we've missed.
Right. I think what I tried to basically wrap it up together, and basically I think what it comes down to is that We like to describe the early modern period in many ways as a period of enclosure. So talking about property rights, like the enclosure movement in England, but also maybe Foucault's great confinement. You have this idea of enclosure rhymes well with this idea that you have what political scientists like to call the Westphalian system. So basically a system that inaugurated a political order predicated upon the autonomy of sovereign states and non-intervention in domestic affairs. And I think what every chapter in the book in some way shows is that in reality, these polities were very ill-equipped for this role that political theory has thrust upon them, right? And not only that, in fact, the constitutional order of the Holy Roman Empire, the Westphalian treaties themselves guaranteed extensive rights of transit, of trade, and of migration. I think the book also shows, I guess, that the early modern period is a time of transition in which the governance of movement at the state level remained punctual and, if you like, almost rhizomatic rather than aerial. It also shows that the old Reich, the Holy Roman Empire, looks like a closed reality if one looks at its cities. But compared to the modern border regime, its territories were very much open. So I think what's important is that questioning this idea of closable borders should not mean that stumbling right from one extreme to another. It's very tempting to frame the pre-modern history of migration and mobility in opposition to an immobile conception of old regime societies. But today you have so many advocates of a mobile, connected and global early modernity that the myth of pre-modern immobility is pretty much shattered. And the pendulum perhaps threatens to swing too far, right? Everything early modern seems to have been in flux. And those who highlight elements of friction or of stasis are easily portrayed as dupes of anti-feudal sentiment. And I think it's important to realize that diagnosis of modern and pre-modern spatial orders vary with the scales of analysis. So a lot of the functions of the territorial border at the time were filled by the city wall. And then late modernity has witnessed other forms of spatial segregation from the ghetto right to the reservation. And early modern politics of mobility combined fluidity and friction, right? It yielded widely different results for different social, cooperative, religious, or economic groups at different times. And it's a complicated story, really. So clearly, there was a long intellectual tradition in favor of free movement, but this tradition could be connected to projects of hegemonic rule and violent conquest, right? And the history of the empire invites historians to separate the problems of statehood and border control But it also suggests that spatial considerations only tell us a part of the story, right? So you can have a borderless landscape replete with gated communities. So the case of the empire is, I think, a reminder that the language of borders ultimately is a very poor resource for understanding the politics of mobility. The border talk, the kind that we hear a lot nowadays, right, which is emphasis on dichotomies like open and closed and inside and outside, it obscures the fact that the politics of mobility is usually characterized by an interplay of obstructive and accelerating factors that affect different forms of movement in different ways. And I think the history of the Holy Roman Empire, in that sense, points us beyond our late modern infatuation with the border, right? It shows that the ways in which societies channel mobility can be simultaneously promotive and restrictive, socially exclusionary, highly contingent, spatially dispersed, and ultimately morally ambiguous.
Yeah, wow. Well done. That was a great conclusion. Well done. That's very exciting. So is this work you continue? Are you going to, we're going to see more on this topic from you? What are you working on now?
I don't think I'm going to continue work specifically on this problem. It's actually my next project is in all likelihood going to be a spatial history of the hail cannon. So you had for a long time, in the especially 18th and 19th century, people were convinced that by shooting at the clouds, you could push a storm away. So what I want to do is I want to use meteorological and climate data to map these, to create a spatial history of that. And in a sense, what my idea is that spatial historians are very much married to a horizontal conception of space. And that's also the case of the book that I just talked about. And what I want to do with this project is I want to explore how mapping technologies can help us to explore verticality and volume, right? And try, yeah, and basically understand the atmospheric environment in which mm-hmm. this kind of history played out.
So where is this work going to happen? Like, what are your sources? Tell me more about this. This is fascinating. I love this.
Right. So this is, this happens. It depends on the regions in Europe. Different regions are affected differently by this. I think I'm particularly going to work on around the Alps. Basically all around the Alps. And one thing that this does is that, so whereas my first book was strictly early modern, this is gonna, in a sense, push me a little bit more into the 19th century. So it's mostly gonna be centered around the 18th and the 19th century.
Will do, won't it? Oh, that's so cool. You know, we have this tradition of this in the US. As well, and it's the Great Plains states.
Okay.
And they're dealing with drought because there are all these farming places, and if it doesn't rain, they're screwed. So you have, and it's the same people who are selling snake oil. I think this will be fantastic to see what you find around the Alps. And
yeah, it's definitely who's gonna be doing this. Yeah, it's definitely, it promises to be an interesting story. there's plenty of interesting characters involved in it. No.
Yeah, you're going to meet some very interesting people. I can't wait to read that. Well, and then we'll talk about it then, okay? We'll schedule an appointment after that next book, and you can tell me all about it. All right. Well, thank you so much again, Lucas Schultz, and I wish you the best of luck, and we'll talk again soon. Take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for the interview.